You're listening to Vibes Live Radio with Robin Lynn.
Hello, I'm Robin Lynn Maven, the CEO, creator, and producer of Vibes Live. We have over 2 million geographical listeners reaching 200 countries with nonstop music 24/7. Just tune in on VibesLive.com. Vibes Live has something very special for you right after church, gospel brunch and sunshine. I am Robin Lynn, and join me for Jazz with Jay every Sunday and a glass of wine on VibesLive.com, 12 noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
So nice, so that's what I like.
I say the hip hop, you just don't stop it, and just get ready to jam. The Disco Daddy Wide World of Hip Hop Radio Show, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, only on VibesLive.com, with special guests every week. Don't miss it.
Hello out there, Disco Daddy here. Welcome to another edition of Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. Today, we have a very special guest. All month long, we're going to be interviewing legends who are legends in hip hop, but you may not know who they are. You may not have ever heard the name, unless you're a student of hip hop or you're hardcore. These are people who helped build the foundation of some of the greatest groups behind the scenes and along with them also, but never quite got the individual attention that they probably deserve. Well, we're going to rectify that today, and we're going to start with one of the people who was a member and a DJ of one of the most dangerous groups in hip-hop history, Public Enemy. His name is Johnny Juice Rosado. Now, Juice is well known in hip-hop. However, the public, we know that there's a lot of young people out there who do not know the history, and that's one of the reasons we created this show, Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip-Hop. So today, we're going to dedicate a whole hour to this man because he's earned it. And when you finish listening to his story, you will completely understand why we're giving him the entire hour for this show. Mr. Johnny Juice Rosado, welcome to Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip-Hop.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate that.
How are you today?
I'm outstanding, as we used to say in the military.
Okay. Now, this is the way we're going to do this. Many people have heard of Public Enemy. Fewer have heard of the Bomb Squad. But I want to give you maybe 5 or 10 minutes just to explain and where you're from, your early history growing up, and how you even got in the hip-hop culture before you even touched the turntable. Just give us some background on where you're from, where you grew up, and where Johnny Juice Rosado, where his beginnings began.
Well, I'm from the Bronx originally, and I grew up in the Mott Haven section of the Bronx, which is the area where the Casanovas used to kind of roam, and Flash used to play there a lot.
Okay, wait. Okay, yeah. I don't want to interrupt you, but many of our listeners don't know anything about Casanovas, Black Spades. You and I do. Yeah, so break it down to them. That's why we have people start at the very beginning of what was going on around the neighborhoods and what they were from. What were the Casanovas? What role did they play?
All right, well, everybody should know by now that Kool Herc bought his equipment out for his sister Cindy's back to school party in 1973, and that was the birth of what we call hip hop now. And Bambada started what we call the Zulu Nation, which was an offshoot of the Black Spades, which was a gang, which was a gang in New York. Back in the 70s, there were a lot of gangs in New York. Like that, like the movie The Warriors, when they had Cyrus and he was trying to get the gangs together. That was kind of based on an event that happened with the Ghetto Brothers, who actually formed a troop with all the gangs in New
York.
And
what were we talking about, 73 to like 75, something like that?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Matter of fact, one of the Ghetto Brothers just passed away, Yellow Benji, rest in peace.
Wow.
But yeah, just passed away just very recently. But when the Bronx started transitioning from gangs to hip to what we now know as hip hop, there was a big overlap. So there was still gangs when there was hip hop in the early days. I started out as a writer, as a graffiti writer, and as a b-boy, because those were the most accessible to me as a youngster. I was young.
What years were you starting out with this?
About
very
me,
important. We try to get a chronology that you started
between 77 and 79. I moved from Patterson Projects, which is where AG from Showbiz and AG's from. Not far from there was DJ AJ
in Harlem.
No, this was in the Bronx.
The Bronx, Patterson. Okay.
So I moved a few blocks north to 149th and Morris to Michelangelo. And when I was living there, my next door neighbor was the famous Joe Conzo, the photographer that did the book Born in the Bronx. He was the photographer for the Cold Crush Brothers.
Wow.
A lot of those flyers you see back in the days with the Cold Crush on it, Joey did the photography. Now Joey would have the Cold Crush Brothers at his house all the time, and also people like Fable from Rocksteady, Wiggles and Fable. There was a b-boy crew called the Magnificent Force at the time, Freddie Fresh, Icy Ice. Those cats would always be around Joey's crib, and since I was best friends with Joey's brother Jared and our boy Boo Boo, we'd hang out over there and watch these guys do their thing and try to emulate them. And I started b-boying. Then I started as a b-boy and working my way up. And when you're a young kid and you're nice with the moves, they would kind of let you in the cipher, you know, and say, look at little man, you know, going off, you know. So they watch me, you know, going off, because before it was breakdancing, before all of that, it was called going off.
Okay.
It was called going off, and then... Right, and then it transitioned into the floor moves, which became floor rocking. I am currently the vice president of the first all-Latino rocking crew, the Bronx Boys. Which was started in 74 as a graffiti crew and then transitioned to a rocking crew in 75. Our members are credited with creating foundation moves like the three-step, which was created by Batch, Russian Kicks, which was created by Abby, his brother, the W, and the Pretzel Freeze, which was created by Trace 2. Crazy Legs made those famous. And eventually in 79, when the crew broke up, our Burnside division spun off and became the Rocksteady Crew.
Okay.
So from transition from the 70s to the 80s, in the early 80s, my family came into a little bit of money after we sued a medical facility, a hospital, for something that happened to my mother, and we moved to Long Island. We moved to Long Island in the early 80s, and I was still making my weekend trips back to the Bronx, but I started doing my b-boying out in Long Island, and I ran into a cat named DJ Will. He was the resident dope DJ in the neighborhood, so I started kind of hanging with him and trying to learn. And at the same time, I was trying to, you know, make my name, so I was already making my name as a b-boy. I ran into a young cat named, his name was Trevor Smith. Later on, he would be known as Busta Rhymes. But Trevor became my b-boy, him and his little brother Paul. And we had a little crew. We transitioned to a little rap group. And eventually I ran into the big DJ on Long Island, DJ Higg, who did all the clubs. Now, Higg had a younger brother named Brian Higgins. Brian Higgins would later go on to be known as Charlie Brown. So me hanging
now,
with Higg.
What year was this? And any of the clubs like Fantasia and any of the some of the people I interviewed from Queens, the clubs started popping up over there. Was this during that period or before that?
That was about 83 to 80, 85. It was about this time period.
Before.
Right. So we was, you know, it was mainly Long Island cats, and they had like little clubs in Long Island, like Feathers and Roxy's and things like that, and Uncle Sam's. There was a bunch of clubs out in Long Island. I forgot the one that was way out. Faces and Comac. Mm. You know, there was a lot of clubs out there that had teen nights, and I was a teenager, so I was doing teen nights. But Higg was DJing both the teen nights and the regular nights, so he had it on lock.
Okay.
So I was rolling with him wherever I could. I was his DJ partner. He would do the mixes, and I would do the cuts. And he started teaching me how to mix better, and I became real good at mixing. I was ready nice and scratching. And then I hooked up with his younger brother, Charlie Brown, and we became a crew. His name was KBMC at the time. Eventually, Busta became a part of the crew. He was MC Chillo Ski. And it was me, Busta, and Brown. We were called the Bum Rush Crew.
And this is like 85?
85, yep, about 85. Hmm.
Okay.
And 83, 84, 85. We even opened up for a couple of artists like Alicia. She did that song, Two Turned On. She did a lot. That was like the freestyle movement at the time. And, you know, we would do little shows here and there. And we were getting a little love. And eventually.
Were you DJing or MCing or what?
I was DJing.
Okay, you're the DJ. Okay.
Now, I mean, I would write rhymes too because everybody wrote rhymes. But I was the DJ there with the rappers. And we would put together mixtapes and little pause button tapes. So I make these beats out of pause buttons. Eventually, we heard about a contest. And that these cats called Spectrum City was having. Spectrum City was a local sound system in Long Island. Consisted of MC Chucky D, MC DJ Flavor, DJ Melody, and DJ Wizard KG.
And these are all Long Island people?
They were all Long Island people. Spectrum City would later become Public Enemy. So they did a radio show on BAU, which was Adelphi University. And it was pretty popular. A lot of people up there. There was the Spectrum City Hour Power, Mr. Bill Most Chill. That's Bill Stephanie. He would go on to become vice president of Def Jam. Dr. Dre in the operating room. He would go on to become the host of MTV Raps.
Right.
And the head of this group, Original Concept. So they were getting funneled through the Def Jam chain since about 85, about that time. About the same time I hooked up with them. They wanted to do management. So they tried to have these contests, and whoever won, they would manage them and get them signed. Well, that
Spectrum
first
City wanted to do that. Spectrum City wanted to do that. Okay,
exactly.
And it was Chuck D was still the leader at that time. He was they were beginning. They weren't even Public Enemy, but Chuck D was there.
Now, they were Spectrum City for a while by this time, they were on the cusp of signing a deal with Def Jam in '86. So I came in with Brown. Busta was supposed to show up, but he didn't show up. And me and Brown went with one of our homeboys. We thought we were going to battle as a crew, but it was a one-on-one battle. All the DJs battled and all the MCs battled. I won the DJ battle. So I became they put together a group called the Kings of Pressure, and we were signed to Next Plateau. But I would still bring Brown to the rehearsal studio with me all the time. So eventually Chuck put him and Busta down and made them a bunch of different crews until eventually they settled on the name Leaders of the New School. While I was doing Kings of Pressure, and I did a song, You Know How to Reach Us, and one called Give Me the Mic, which I rapped on. Chuck asked me one day while he was driving me back home if I would do some scratching on their album. And I said, sure. So he pops in the cassette, and the first song I heard was My Uzi Weighs a Ton. So I said, oh, you're doing an album? He goes, yeah, we're going to call ourselves Public Enemy. And
this is very important. What year was that conversation?
86, early 86.
86, okay. The birth of Public Enemy. Go ahead, Johnny Juices Otto.
Right, so I went and Chuck picked me up, drove me out to INS Studios in Manhattan, and I did all the scratching on the Public Enemy's first album in one studio set. Simultaneously, Duke Booty was in another room in INS. Duke Booty is the guy known as he did that song King Cut by word of mouth, but he was also the guy that wrote the song The Message.
The Message, right.
Right.
Okay.
So Duke Booty was doing I think his name is Ed Fletcher. He was doing he was working in another room, and I got to meet him. That was my first taste of, you know, getting into the rap world. Did the PE joints. and almost immediately afterwards started working on the second album, It Takes a Nation. Doing production for people like True Mathematics,
okay.
Slick Rick, a whole bunch of people. So
break this down for us. When you're doing production, you're a DJ.
Yeah.
You did that first one. When you're doing production, what does that really mean? What did you actually do? Obviously, you weren't just spinning a record in the studio. What did Johnny Juice Rosado actually contribute every time when you're doing talking about production? I know that you did a lot of things, but we, again, this is for the public, for information, to understand how deeply embedded you are with
the
Public
thing is,
Enemy logo.
Right. When it first started out, we had this little rehearsal studio. Not really a rehearsal studio. We called it a studio. It was just a spot to hold all the equipment that they had that they get parties
okay.
with. And we shared
right.
the space with a DJ, a mobile DJ named EJ the DJ. And there was nothing but records all over this room. We only had a little drum machine. We had a Korg DDD-1 and an Ensoniq Mirage. We didn't have any real flash stuff initially. So
right.
we would sit there and just pull records out, man, and find dope stuff to sample. Sometimes it would be sampled. Sometimes it'd be scratched in. You know, we would kind of assemble records like that. Eric Sadler.
Right.
He had a rehearsal studio downstairs because he was a musician. He played. And he knew how to program drum machines and keyboards because he was originally slated to produce Eddie Murphy's first album.
Oh, okay.
And, because Eddie was from the same town as Chuck Roosevelt, and they all knew each other. So Eric was going to do that album eventually.
Was that the one with What's Up With You?
It's the one with My Girl Wants My Girl Wants to Party All the Time. So what eventually happened was Eddie went with Rick James instead of Eric Sadler. But Eric had all the state-of-the-art stuff that Eddie bought him. He knew how to program all that stuff. So he asked, Chuck and Hank asked him to come up and, be the tech, and do that.
Right.
But since Eric played instruments, he started to lend his ear too. That doesn't work. That bass line doesn't work with this. This key is dissonant, it's not in key. It's not in tune with this piece. And then of course, us not knowing music as well would say, who cares? So I think that dynamic of all these people trying to get their voices across on the record kind of contributed to the very agitated sound. And since, I did the scratching, if you listen to a lot of the samples, they're scratched in. They're not just triggered.
Gotcha.
And then we grew from there. We all learned. I learned how to program. I know how to read music. I learned how to write music. I played percussion and drums, and I started learning keys and what have you. So everybody grew, and as we grew, our sound grew. And as Public Enemy got bigger, more clients came to us, like Dougie Fresh when we did Rising to the Top, or Slick Rick when we did half of his first album, The Great Adventures of Slick Rick. I was asked to come scratch on other stuff. I remember I was asked by Rick Rubin to come in and scratch on some stuff with the Beastie Boys. So eventually it became a situation where we were the in-house production team that was managed by Russell Simmons, Rush Production. So whatever was going down with Def Jam, we had a hand in at least some of it. It Gets No Rougher by LL Cool J. I said, Slick Rick's first album. Ice Cube's first album, obviously. What else? Belle Biv DeVoe. Remixes like Tumbling Down by Ziggy Marley or Friends by Jody Watley. A lot of those kind of things.
So where is the Bomb Squad? Is the Bomb Squad born during this period? Is it a separate entity? How did that come about?
Well, unfortunately, it came about because of credit issues and money issues. Now, the whole first two Public Enemy albums, there is no mention of the Bomb Squad because even though the members of the Bomb Squad worked on the albums, we weren't listed as the Bomb Squad. Now, eventually there was some beef as to why wasn't everybody's name listed as producers. Now, on the first album, it was, I think it says produced by Bill Stephanie. Or it might have been produced by, I don't remember who it said, but I know it wasn't any of us. And on the second album, it was produced by Hank Shockley, associate producer Eric Sadler, and of course Chuck's production name, Carl Ryder. His real name is Carlton Rod now, but Carl Ryder was his producer then. So there was people like beefing, and even Keith, who was Hank's brother, was like, "Yo, what's going on?" So Chuck created the name Bomb Squad to create an umbrella name so that everybody's name that was in it, you would get credit no matter what songs were done. If Bomb Squad does it, your name will be on it.
Yeah.
So that was meant to pacify everybody. Unfortunately, I left about the time the Bomb Squad name came out. So my name was I left because, you know, because of those reasons why the Bomb Squad name was created. You know, money, credit, so I went away for a while. And
And what year was that you split?
What year I split in 88, right after 88. Right before Slick Rick's album was released and Ice Cube's album was released. I worked on a lot of that stuff, and then I left. So it wasn't even released yet. Just like Public Enemy's second album. Actually, the first album, Yo Bum Rush the Show, was done in 86, but it wasn't released until 87. Pushed back because of Beastie Boys' first album. So I left, and there was albums and songs that I worked on that weren't even out. And that happens. I mean, if you listen to the rhymes on Do Me Baby, those were written by Charlie Brown and Busta Rhymes. Uncredited. That backstage underage, that was Charlie Brown's rhyme. Matter of fact, it was on their second album. And Brown had to rewrite the lyrics for a song, Syntax Error, because they came out on the Vogue album.
Right. Okay. You leave in 88, and then where did that take you there? Now, Public Enemy is steadily blowing up, however. That probably was the beginning of their prime time period. Where does Johnny Juice Rosado go now?
Well, Johnny Juice Rosado mysteriously disappeared to the military. I went to the military.
Really? You're a veteran?
Yep. I'm a veteran. I'm a combat veteran.
Thank you for your service, sir.
Yeah. So I left, went to the military, didn't even tell Chuck. Matter of fact, Eric Sadler called my house looking for me to work on a song, and my mother's like, "John is gone." They're like, What do you mean, God? What do you mean, John is God? And I was like, he went to the military, and they were like, "What?" I didn't tell nobody. I just left. I didn't tell anybody in the crew. So I up and left. I'm like, forget this. I had to get away. I had to get away from all of that, and I did. And it was good.
Let me explore that for a minute. You leave what is becoming one of the most popular groups in the world at the time when hip hop is going full blast. At what moment did you decide to go? I can understand the feelings. I mean, you just explained that. But what moment did you decide, instead of like going and producing other people or working for somebody else, why the military?
Because I had to get away from New York. I had to get away from the bad vibes, negative energy. Mm-hmm. I had to get away. And I wasn't scared to leave, you know.
I think
a lot of people stay in situations like that because they're defined by those situations.
Huh.
I wasn't. I didn't feel defined by it. At the time, I was on the national taekwondo team. Martial arts. I was a very accomplished martial artist. I was a highly advanced student. I had other things that I could have pursued, which is what I did. I went to the Navy. I became an electronic technician, and then I got bored with that, and then I decided to do something a little more adventurous in the military and became part of special warfare.
Wow.
And then I eventually went to the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was doing all of this, I was still working on music. I was messing with, and I know it sounds weird, but I started messing with these white boy bands in San Diego and stuff like that, and I started learning how to produce rock records, and I started doing something different. I started working with different styles of music, you know, a lot of the Chicano groups in San Diego, a lot of the sound that was the West Coast, and I learned a lot of things that I ended up bringing back with me. And eventually, I unfortunately got sick from whatever happened to me overseas.
Right.
I woke up one day, I was paralyzed from the neck down.
Wow.
I couldn't move anything.
Wow. No physical injury? You didn't fall down or anything? I mean, you know.
Well, I fell down.
Woke up like that?
I fell down because my legs stopped working, but I didn't fall down.
Right.
Me being paralyzed wasn't a result of a physical.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Or any kind of impact injury.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what it was, and they didn't know what it was, and they eventually figured out what it might have been, and they started trying to work to fix me, and then they made it worse for a minute. Then I got better, but I had to kind of relearn how to do a lot of things. At the time, I was training for the Olympics, in Taekwondo, in 92.
Wow.
And that just ruined that.
Mm.
So, and I was the current national champion in my weight class. So
okay,
that kind of ruined that. And
what year was this happening to you? I assume you applied for discharge after, but what year was this happening to you?
That happened in 1992, in May of 1992.
Okay, Gulf War.
Well, this is after the Gulf War, but symptoms started showing up in 91, but they were like. It just felt like I worked out a lot, you know, which I was working out a lot. So I'm like, well, maybe I need to just relax a little bit. Felt like my muscles were tight, but I didn't have any paralysis issues. Even though one time I did fall down a flight of stairs because my legs just stopped working. And I'm like, wow, man, I thought I was just too tired. I was working out too much. I'm like, let me just relax. Eventually, like I said, when I woke up, I couldn't move. That became the point where I knew something was horribly wrong. They worked on me. I became temporarily assigned to a training command. That way I could try to rehabilitate. And I got better, but not the way I wanted to. So I finished my 6 years in 94, and I got out. I came back to New York, started working with Charlie Brown on a solo album, which we never released a couple of singles, but we never released the album. I still have it on my hard drive. I slowly but surely started getting back into I started bumping into Chuck, and he would ask me to work on some, and I would work on a one-off with him, but, you know, there was still some, you know, unfinished business between us. And some loose ends. We ended up straightening that out, and then I came back and did He Got Game with them.
Okay. And what year was this?
I think that was 98.
98, okay. So from 92 to 98, basically, you sort of repairing in repair mode, trying
94.
To get your life together, up to 94.
But 94, when I got out of the military, I was kind of in repair mode.
Okay.
I started working at a reggae studio. I was doing a lot of reggae stuff. My boy, Philip Smart, rest in peace, and Mikey McDonald. Worked on everything from Shaggy Records to Supercat, Ray Vaughn, to Maxi Priest, Junior Cat, Lexus, a lot of reggae stuff. And while I was doing that, I was working with some of the hip-hop artists that came out of Long Island at the time, like The Matrix and, of course, Brown and them. And then eventually I hooked back up with Chuck in 98 for He Got Game. Afterwards, Chuck wanted me to kind of be involved with his label, Slam Jams, which we talked about. And then eventually, I think about 2000 or 2001, I ran into Chuck at a Walmart of all places, and he told me he was buying some stuff, and I was buying stuff. He told me he was going to Chicago to film a blues documentary called Godfathers and Sons. And he said, "Yo, leaving Friday, I'm gonna come by your crib. I'm gonna get you. You gotta be in this." I'm like, "Yeah, all right, whatever." We've always had situations where he's like, "Yo, this is gonna happen," and nothing happens. Well, he came to my crib. He was right. We flew out to Chicago, and we met up with the cats from Chess Records. If you ever seen that movie, Cadillac Records?
Yeah.
That movie was about Chess Records.
Okay.
So I met the son of the former owners one of the former owners of Chess Records, Marshall Chess. His father and his uncle ran Chess Records. Marshall produced a couple of records. He produced Electric Mud, for Muddy Waters. He produced an electric album for Howlin' Wolf. And eventually he left to become Rolling Stones manager, and he came back when his father passed away. So Marshall was representing Chess Records, and he brought in the studio musicians that worked on Muddy Waters' Electric Mud album.
Wow.
And we redid that song, Dan, 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 Dan. Yeah, we know that record.
Oh.
I was a young boy, Dan, 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 Dan. The age of five, Dan, Dan, Dan.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I'm so mad. The greatest man alive. It's called Man is Boy, or I'm a Man.
Wow.
So the session musicians that were there, they were there. All the old cats, Maurice Jennings, Pete Cozy, Phil Upchurch. Gene Barge, Louis Satterfield, you know, a lot of them guys. So they were all there.
What was that like? Were you aware of who these cats were? I know you knew the main man, but did you know any of the history of any of those cats that you were there with?
I knew the history of all of them.
Wow.
Chuck calls me the human Wikipedia. Now keep in mind, at this particular point, the internet wasn't prolific like it is now. You know,
right.
Cell phones were just barely new. And I had a Sky pager, I remember, because I got when we was out there in Chicago, Aaliyah passed away while I was in the studio that she recorded her first album, and I was looking at her out a gold album when I heard
Wow.
It. But yeah.
Wow.
And I also met Etta James that night. But we were in the studio with these cats. Now, I knew who these cats were. And they thought I was just some DJ, so they were like really not impressed. They respected Chuck because of who Chuck is, but they were like, "Yeah, you're not even a musician." So I had to earn my respect. So I jumped on the drums. I recorded a drum track. I synced it with my drum machine, which I had with me. I scratched in some stuff. I played some keys. I actually created a song live.
Now they're watching you do all of this.
While I were eating, they didn't even realize I was doing this. They're listening. They're like,
"Wow, okay."
They went to the engineer and said, "Yo, you know what's this?" They're like, "Juice is doing this right now." And they're like, "What?" So afterwards, you know, they're like, "Yo, come here, boy. Let me talk to you." You know, like, what was that, boy? You know, at first, you know, they won't even let me eat chicken with them. Like, you know, you can't eat chicken.
Right, right.
And now they're like, "Hey, come here. We'll have a piece of chicken. Let me talk to you." So, and
that's cool.
I knew everything they worked. Well, not everything,
okay.
But I knew their bio extensively.
Wow.
But I'm a DJ and I read liner notes, so I know Phil Upchurch played with George, Donnie Hathaway and Curtis Mayfield. I know he played on Thriller. I know he played on Off the Wall. I know that Pete Cozy played with Miles Davis, and he also played with the Pharaohs, who became Earth, Wind & Fire later, and he also played with, you know, Herbie Hancock, and you know, I knew Maurice Jennings, the drummer. I know he played with Ramsey Lewis Trio. I also know that he played the drums on that record, Different Strokes by Syl Johnson, that was sampled by Coogee Rap for Talks Like Sex.
Man,
the one with the chick laughing in the beginning. Oh,
right.
Oh, that record. That's Maurice Jennings playing the drums on that, and that chick that's laughing was Minnie Riperton. So.
Wow.
I knew these things. I knew that Louis Satterfield played bass with Phil Collins, but he played horns with the Phoenix Horns or Earth and the Fire. You know, I knew who they were. I knew Gene Barge produced Here Come the Judge by Pygmy Markin, played with Etta James, played with everybody. So when I started running down their history, they're like, "Oh, this boy knows his stuff." And I'm like, "Yeah." And it ended up coming out on PBS. The documentary was produced by Martin Scorsese. And it was part of a 7-part series called The Year of the Blues. So there were 7 movies directed by 7 different people, all produced by Martin Scorsese, executive produced by Martin Scorsese. And ours was one of them. It was on PBS. They showed it one each day of the week, and then it got released as a DVD set. It's still out there.
Mm-hmm.
And Common was in the movie also, because Common's from Chicago. He got down. And then since we filmed some of it in New York at Electric Lady, Questlove and Rozelle in one of the scenes, you know, added hand claps, because they didn't really get down to it. It happened to be there, so added hand claps to the joint. So we had a good time, and that introduced me to a whole new world of musicians and musicians.
Man.
I ended up becoming a member of Pete Cozy's band. Now, Pete Cozy was the guitar player one of the guitar players for the Godfathers and Sons thing, but he also played with Miles Davis, so he formed a band that was a Miles Davis alumni band. A lot of the people in the band were down with Miles Davis, like John and Gary Bartz and Jeff Liebman. So all these cats we played together, and I played percussion because I played congas, bongos, and my turntables. I bought turntables. So I started getting into more of the live jazz movement and doing that kind of thing, and that led to, you know, I mean, I could go on forever, and this would take forever. So, long story short, I started scoring and doing. I started scoring movies and doing jazz stuff that led to Emmy nominations, a few NAACP.
Yeah, now go into that. How did that first? We got time. That's why I'm giving you this whole hour, sir. How was the first movie opportunity to score? How did that come about?
Well, the first one came about because a friend of mine had a brother that directs movies, so it was like it wasn't even a B movie. It was like a D movie. It was so low budget. It was crazy. But I started doing some, you know, low budget movies, and eventually Chuck was in a TV show called Ali Rap. It was a 1-hour special on ESPN when Muhammad Ali turned 65. So they wanted a theme song. So Chuck, you know, hit me up. He's like, "Yo, Juice, where you at?" I'm like, "I'm on my way to the studio. What's up?" He said, "Yo, we need to do this song like tonight for ESPN." I'm like, "Okay, I'll be there." You know, Chuck was literally writing the rhymes while I was writing the beat.
Right.
So we did the song Ali Rap. I mixed it, everything. Within a few hours, sent it to ESPN. They were like, "Perfect." The next day, they were like, "Yo, do you know how to do scores?" I'm like, "Why?" They said, "Well, apparently whoever was supposed to do the scores either didn't come through or something didn't happen, whatever." And they're like, "Yo, if you could do them, we need X amount of pieces of music for the TV show, blah, 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 whatever." No problem. I put together like 9 or 10 pieces of music. I sent it to them. They used all of them except for one. So the whole TV show was about how rap music owes a lot to Muhammad Ali and the way he rhymed, and it was kind of like, and they had people in like Rakim and MC Light.
What year?
That was in, I'm looking at the nomination, 2007.
Okay.
It was nominated for a 28th annual Sports Emmy Award under the category Outstanding Music Composition, Direction, and Lyrics. So we didn't win, but it was nominated. So that special came out, ESPN, it did well. And matter of fact, that production company that actually used my music asked if they could use it for a couple other, the stuff that they didn't use in the first one, they used in some other stuff they did. And then that's when I was like, well, maybe I should concentrate on doing stuff like that. So I did. The trailer to Selma, that movie that came out fairly recently with Oprah, that's my music. I did another documentary called On the Shoulders of Giants that was produced by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar about the first all-African-American professional basketball team. And that came about by mistake because Kareem was on a plane trying to figure out how he was going to get music for his movie because budget was gone, and Chuck happened to be sitting right near him. He heard it. He says, I'll do the theme, of course. He hit me up and says, "Juice, let's do this, but it has to sound like Harlem Renaissance jazz, but still have hip-hop." So I created a piece that sounded like that. They loved it, and then Kareem said, "Can you score?" I said, "Yeah." And he got Brian Cunliffe, who's an Emmy-nominated.
Okay, you were doing this for Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He was the producer.
He was the producer, that's right.
Okay.
And I sat down with Kareem in Manhattan at some spot. We were doing the video editing, and his manager, Deborah, me and Chuck, you know, we ate some food, talked, and we clicked. We hit it off, you know. Really, you know, I mean, he's probably sick of talking about basketball, but I was really talking to him about Bruce Lee because I'm a martial artist, and I know he trained with Bruce.
Because Bruce was still alive. No, Bruce had died. This is 2007 he's talking about. Okay,
Bruce died in 73. So we were talking, you know, and Kareem had cancer. He was going through chemo at the time. So, you know, he was kind of drained. But once I mentioned Bruce Lee, his eyes lit up. Like, boom. You know what I'm saying? Like, ah, like, yo. Like, you could tell that there was a real huge love there. So I was like, man. So we talked for a while, and that's when me and Kareem really clicked. And I did the music for him. along with Bill Cunliffe, and then I had the chance to work with Herbie Hancock and Wynton Marsalis on that, as well as Will.i.am and Chuck, and The Last Poet, Umar Bedarsan from The Last Poets. So
you met The Last Poets.
Well, I met Umar from The Last Poets. It ends up that last year I met Abia Doon from The Last Poets, because he's doing a documentary and I'm part of that as well. But yeah, I met Umar Bedarsan from The Last Poets. But I've met some other Last Poets. I've met Felipe Luciano, who was one of the original Last Poets, before the Last Poets that you know that made the records came out. In any case, that did well. And it won a NAACP Image Award for Best Documentary, and I was nominated, and I'm looking for that right now, the 44th NAACP Image Awards. I was nominated for Outstanding Album on Shoulders of Giants, because I produced that. And I was also nominated for Best Dual Group of Collaboration, along with Chuck, Will.i.am, Herbie Hancock, and Wynton Marsalis. We lost to Whitney Houston. Whitney Houston won the Best Album. And she died that year, so, you know, it was a stacked category. It was Whitney Houston, Michael Jackson's 30th anniversary of Bad, and Alicia Keys. I had no chance in that category. and I think Mary won the Best Duo Group Collaboration. So, but we were nominated, and that was good enough. And because of that, that's led me to do a lot more things. I did the music for, I redid the song Rock Into the Terror Dome for that Samsung VR commercial with LeBron James.
Mm-hmm.
I remade a lot of classic Public Enemy records because we didn't have the masters. What's his name?
Right.
Universal has the masters. So in order for us to license it, I mean, they could still get it for Universal. We'll get paid. But us remaking the masters allows us to place these things without having to talk to Universal at all. And that means more money in our pocket. So
okay.
And ever since, that's what I've been doing, working on new artists when I can, teaching. I have a degree in electrical engineering, so I'm an electronic engineer. I also have Microsoft certifications. I'm an IT guru. I mix all of that together.
Well, let me ask you. A few years ago, did you guys have a parting of ways with the Public Enemy camp, or what happened there?
Yeah, in 2013, well, in 2008, we were inducted into the Long Island Music Hall of Fame, and I kind of spearheaded that.
In what way? Explain that, because again, you remember there are people out here listening, young people who don't know anything about what producing is. That's why I hate to seem like I'm trying to just bug you. Because you know exactly what you're talking about, but we have to break it down for our audience. If you kind of spearheaded it, what part did you play in it?
Well,
obviously, first of all, your part that you played in helping craft their songs helped them get there. So we can take that part for granted. But what else?
Well, what happened was the Long Island Music Hall of Fame was brand new in 2006 or something like that. And they had their first induction ceremony, which I didn't even know about. When they had their second induction ceremony, it was supposed to be in 2007, they ended up not having it that year, but they wanted a certain amount of artists to be inducted. I guess they couldn't reach some of them, or they couldn't find a venue. I don't know what the situation was. But in the meantime, since they had more time to secure artists to induct, I was introduced to somebody, Richard Lahamadou, and he said he was trying to get, he would like it very much if Public Enemy could be inducted. So I had to somehow coordinate Public Enemy to show up and maybe perform, and who's going to induct us. It ends up that DMC from Run DMC inducted us, because even though it's a Long Island Music Hall of Fame, technically Queens and Kings County, which is Brooklyn, are located on Long Island. So.
Right.
So Run DMC was already inducted, I believe, in the first award ceremony, as was Billy Joel and some others. So the second one, it says on the award, it's funny, 2007, but it actually happened in 2008. We went out there, Flav didn't make it. It was Chuck, myself, the S1Ws. And we ended up doing a performance with the band that was there. It was me, Chuck, and DMC performed, actually. That's it, me, Chuck, and DMC with the band. A couple of other groups performed. The guys that sings The Lion Sleeps Tonight, You know the song.
Mm-hmm. Right, yes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They got inducted. Eddie Money got inducted. What are these guys? Blue Oyster Cult, More Cowbell, those dudes. They were sitting, mm-hmm. And LL Cool J, who was sitting next to me, actually. And once that happened, you know, Chuck realized that there's an opportunity for us at our, and that was 2007, so that was the 20th year, that was a 20-year anniversary. Well, 2008 is 21 years, but 20th anniversary of us. So we knew once we made 25 years, it's possible that we could have been eligible to be inducted in the Rock and Roll.
Because it's 25 years is the, again, for the audience, 25 years is the minimum amount of time you have to have existed as a recording artist or entity to be qualified. Right. Okay.
Exactly. So we knew in 2013 that was our year. So we were...
Had Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, had they been inducted yet at this point?
They were the first one. They were the first rap group inducted.
But at the point you're talking about now, had they been inducted? Because I don't recall the year they went in.
That's a good question. Let's see. It was us. The year before us was the Beastie Boys. The year before them was Run DMC. The year before them was Grandmaster Flash. So we were 2013. 2012 was the Beastie Boys.
Yeah, they had been in. They were in. They were in by then. Okay.
Yeah, so okay. We knew that that was a highly probable. Chuck started literally setting things in motion for that to become something, right?
So, setting things in motion specifically, what do you mean?
Things leading
changing
up,
the music or
no, it has nothing to do with the music. Doing certain events, like we did an event in LA at Skid Row, where we did a benefit. We started doing more things that had gravity to add to the weight of something that would be worthy of a rock and roll.
2012, the Skid Row Music Fest, Disco Daddy was there. I was introduced on stage. By Chuck D, and I introduced the West Coast rappers. I'm sorry I didn't know about you then, but I was there. I was backstage. In fact, if you look on my timeline on Facebook, that picture with Chuck D on my timeline, that was taken. That was taken backstage there at the backstage area, and I took one with Flavor Flav too. But 2012. Okay, so the next year they got into the thing. But I see what you're talking about. He started doing different type of events. Was the purpose to expose more people to Public Enemy and the music?
I think it was purposely geared towards helping the induction board see that we were more than just a rap group. I mean, obviously, the content of our music dictated that, but at the same time, you know, we purposely went out our way to do, you know, I mean, Chuck always did events like that, but we made it a priority to really lean into those kind of events and do things.
Okay,
and,
let me ask you another question. Public Enemy is a band. Then they're tight too, but I'm saying when they were Spectrum City, because that's what I wanted to ask you earlier. Skip me. Was Spectrum City? Did they start out the same way as a band? Has it always been a band? And was Flavor Flav down with them from Spectrum City days?
Well, let me start from the beginning. Flavor Flav initially was not a member of Spectrum City, and he was brought to Chuck and his people by a group that we now know as Son of Berserk. Now, Son of Berserk and those dudes, they used to be called the Townhouse Three. It was three of them dudes. It was T.A. the DJ, there was Jawell, and there was Daddy Raw. And they were the ones where Chuck got his inspiration from, because they were around longer than Chuck. They were from Freeport, a neighboring town. Now, Flavor is not from Roosevelt like Chuck is and Griffin. No, he's from Freeport, even though he lives on it's a neighboring town, and he lives on the border block. But he's technically from the town over. So Flav used to roll with those dudes. Now, they already had a dude that did their hype man stuff. His name was Mike, and he happened to be Flav's cousin. So They didn't really have a position for them. So when they went up to the radio station that Chuck and them had, and they were doing a college radio, and to be interviewed, they're like, "Yo, this is our boy Flav. You know, we don't really, you know, maybe y'all guys could work with him because we didn't have any job for him." So Chuck brought him in and said, "Why don't you rhyme on this, or not, why don't you do this intro vocal on this mixtape we did in 1983 for the song Public Enemy Number One." That's how old that song, even though it was released in 86 as a single.
Okay.
So Flav got down on it and Chuck didn't like the way his vocals were, and he's like, "Yo, you got to add more, you know, excuse the pun, flavor." So Flav didn't know what to do, so Chuck said, "Act like your cousin Mike." That whole year, it's like, boy, that's his cousin Mike. That's his style. So that's what he did. And it's weird because since Flav came out first, when Son of Berserk came out, they said, "Yeah, that dude down with Son of Berserk kind of sounds like Flavor." Now it's the other way around. So Flav eventually became part of their little squad at that time. Now, fast forward in the future, Griff, when he went on his own, wanted to do rock music. So he created this band called the Seventh Octave. When he was in this band, the Seventh Octave, that it was a rock band. Drums, guitar, bass, turntables, which was DJ Lord, and him on vocals. So Griff talked Chuck into bringing the band on the road with him as a backing element, and that's how it started. And then the band ended up changing members, and then some of the members left, and so instead of being the Seventh Octave, Griff kept the Seventh Octave separate, and now the band, Public Enemy's band, became the band. B-A-N-N-E-D. So the band was Brian Hargrove on bass, Mike Faulkner on drums, and Kari Wynn on guitar. And the bass players fluctuated, but Brian Hargrove ended up becoming a band leader, and he's toured with everybody. He was Bootsy Collins' music director. Hargrove is no longer with them. He left, and now Davey DMX, the original Davey D, as in One for the Trouble, Two for the Bass, Davey D, is now the bass player for Public Enemy's band. And T-Bone is the drummer, and Kyrie's still the guitar player. So they're very talented cats. And I even produced an album for the band called Band for Life, where I was a member of the band as a DJ, along with DJ Lord. So we toured with them in 2010, I think. The band has since become an integral part of PE. And that was probably in the early 2000s.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Now, I'm going to throw some names out at you. And I want you to just give me a synopsis of what it was like working with some of these people and what they were like, basically. Flavor Flav came. Did he come in before the first album was cut?
Of course.
Okay. Now, so tell me, what type of person is Flavor Flav from working with him as an artist and everything? We all know they're all talented, but we're trying to sketch out with the members of the group, their different personalities, because you've got all these different talents and everything meshing together to form, along with you, people like you contributing in the production in, the world's most dangerous band. So, Flavor Flav.
Well, Flavor Flav has always been kind of Flavor Flav. One thing that maybe that people don't realize, you could easily see Flavor Flav's growth throughout the career. On the first Public Enemy album, he wasn't this clown funny dude. He was actually an antagonistic asshole, excuse the phrase. He was talking crap the whole album. That's right. Nine ain't gonna stop the bum rush, Holmes. He was actually an antagonizer. He was actually an instigator on that album. He wasn't this funny joke dude. That actually came later. He actually grew into that role because people started thinking he sounded funny. But if you listen to the first album, he's not joking. There's no jokes on there. He's talking trash. Like, what you gonna do? That's who he was. And it just, you know, the more people started, you know, digging him and weird dances he was doing and the clothes he was wearing, he started believing in his own character and he started changing, slowly morphing into the Flav we know now. But he's always been a real good dude with a big heart, and he'll give you the shirt off his back if he has.
Okay. Wow. Okay, Terminator X.
Terminator X, very quiet, brother. His name used to be DJ Mello D, so that's automatically should give you an indication of his temperament. He wasn't really a scratch DJ like that, and I think initially he was probably very uncomfortable with the name Terminator X and that kind of thing. At this particular point, you know, he's learned to live with that, and he didn't even have the scratch skills probably required, which is one of the reasons why I was asked to do some of the scratching. But eventually, he rose to the role that he was given. He was given a huge role in Public Enemy. Because it's just the gravity of the name and the songs that Chuck made with his name on it.
Right.
You know, it is what it is. But you know, a lot of times when Terminator X's name was said on the record, it was actually me. So.
Wow. Okay. Wow. So did you guys work together during the same time period, or did he come in? Was he a member of Spectrum City, first of all?
Right, he was. His name was Melody. If you listen to Public Enemy number 1, the very first record, Chuck said, and Chucky D, myself, and KG Flavor, DJ Melody. That record, Public Enemy number 1, was made in 1983 before they were known as Public Enemy. They were still Spectrum City. So KG was Keith Shockley. He was a DJ too. But, you know, and there's some songs that Chuck did the scratching on Welcome to the Teledome. I mean, he did scratching before anybody got to the studio because he had ideas, and by the time everybody got there, it was like, you know what, the scratching's done. I'm like, okay, and we listen back to it. To be honest with you, the scratching on Terradome is horrible, but the song is so ridiculously powerful that scratches that are offbeat kind of sound like they should be offbeat. I mean, it sounds like everything's agitated on purpose, so it gives the impression that there's some genius happening when in reality it was just not really couldn't scratch well, and it just sounds good for what it is.
Okay.
That's what happened.
Okay. Wow. Johnny Juice Rosado. Now I want to ask you about Chuck D, the leader of Spectrum City, the orchestrator of probably one of the greatest groups, hip-hop or not, in the history of music. What type of person is he? What is he like to work with?
Well, Chuck is also a very quiet man. He's a Leo, just like me, and like Griff. Actually, Griff and Chuck's birthday are exactly the same day. Same day, same year. So Chuck, you know, Chuck is a very quiet man. He doesn't prefer the limelight at all. He's equally humble and egotistical. You just never see the ego part because he's very good at keeping Carlton riding however where he needs to be and keeping Chuck D where he needs to be. Very bright dude. At the same time, he knows what he doesn't know, and he knows how to keep the right. He knows how to keep the right people around him to make them look good. He has a very good idea of perspective. So when he writes, it's not just insightful, but he understands how it fits into the fabric of what's happening, which is why he works so well with that. He was older than most rappers at the time when he came out. He was 26. So, you know, he wasn't like LL, who was 16 when he first came out, or a lot of these rappers were teenagers. He was a grown man with a bachelor's degree in graphic design. And, you know, he had a plan. He was a grown man. And I think a lot of that was instilled by his father, Mr. Rodenhauer, who passed away earlier this year, the day after the Super Bowl, in fact. And his father was a great man, and Chuck followed suit, and I think that, you know, his father, and I know that his father was very proud of him, but Chuck is a man's man, you know what I'm saying? And it shows on the records, you know. You hear what you see is what you get.
Okay. Now, Johnny Juice Rosado, I want to thank you for your time. I want to thank you for your contribution to hip-hop. I hope more people know more about you and how you help Public Enemy attain the status as one of the most premier groups in the world, hip hop or not, and also your contribution to hip hop because of what you've done behind the scenes for films and documentaries, is your effect is probably incalculable. Johnny Juice Rosado, one of the legends of hip hop that you probably have never heard of unless you're like him and me. We're DJs. We read liner notes. We read the small print, okay? So we sort of educate ourselves and we pride ourselves. Plus, I want to say also, Johnny Juice Rosado, you are an encyclopedic type of person with your memory. You are succinct, concise. You remember names and dates. We want your career to blossom from here. And hopefully, people who did not know anything about Johnny Juice Rosado and his role in hip-hop culture, and he is a legend, know more about you now, okay? We want to have you back in the future. But what is Johnny Juice Rosado doing right now? What projects are you working on, and where can people find you on the Internet and your music?
Okay, well, you can go to www.djjohnnyjuice.com. You can see my stuff there. If you go to Facebook /DJ Johnny Juice, you can see me there. On Twitter, I'm at Johnny Juice. Instagram, I'm at DJ Johnny Juice. Email, if you want to correspond, it's johnnyjuice@gmail.com. That's johnnyjuice@gmail.com. I'm in the process of producing about 4 different albums right now. I'm working on 2 movie scores. I'm directing a documentary on my B-Boy crew, the Bronx Boys Rocking Crew. I'm playing as a conga player, percussionist with Zaina Asili and La Banda Rebelde, which is a Latin fusion band. I'm also a part of a duo called The Odyssey, which is an electronica-type music where I'm pretty much the whole band, along with a bass player, lead singer, KJ. I'm also working on new leaders of the new school stuff. You name it, I'm working on it. And I'm also working on the Johnny Juice album with some surprises. Some famous DJs, legendary DJs like DJ Jazzy Jeff and Cash Money, and also some famous old school artists like Mandrill and The Emotions. I've worked with Mavis Staples before, so Mavis might get on the album as well. So it'll be a mixture of legendary hip hop people and legendary R&B cats. Steve Arrington from Sling, you know, cats like that. So it's going to be a surprise. It's going to be a pretty dope album.
Beautiful. Keep us informed, okay? And I want to thank you again for everything and contributing your time to my show. I know you're a very busy man. Johnny Juice Rosado, y'all. Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop.
So wasn't it a great show? Come back next week, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Central Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop Show. Man, it's a great one. Epic. See you next week. Bye.